Good morning. Thank you all for being here for the for Zazenkai, the return to the rock of our practice, Zazen, and also to be here to share the Dharma together. Today we'll look at a koan, case number 25 in the Hekigan Roku. The master of Lotus Flower Peak holds up his staff. The Hekigan Roku is the second classical collection of koans that we work with in the curriculum at this temple and in this lineage. It's a collection of 100 cases compiled by Zen Master Shui Do. His Japanese name is Secho. He collected the cases and wrote a verse for each one. And then one of his successors, some 60 years later, Yuan Wu, whose Japanese name is Engo, added very extensive commentaries, more verses, line-by-line comments, and so on. Today we'll work on just the main case and Shui To's verse. The case reads, "The master of Lotus Flower Peak held up his staff and showed it to his disciples, saying, 'When the ancients got here, why didn't they remain?' There was no answer from the assembly, so he answered for them, 'Because it is of no use in everyday life.' And again he asked, 'What will you do with it?' And again he himself answered in their place, 'Taking no heed of others, I place my staff across my shoulders. I go straight ahead, deep into the recesses of the myriad peaks.'" And the verse, "Dust and sand in his eyes, dirt in his ears. He doesn't consent to stay in the myriad peaks. Falling flowers, flowing streams, very vast. Suddenly, raising my eyebrows to look, where is he gone?" We don't know a great deal about this master of Lotus Flower Peak. He was not the abbot of a great temple. In fact, in some translations of this koan, he's called the hermit of Lotus Flower Peak. He is believed to be a Dharma grandson of Yunmen, that's Umon in Japanese. This would put him in the early part of the Sung Dynasty, just a little bit after the Tang, the so-called Golden Age of Zen. He lived in a little hut on Lotus Flower Mountain, and he did have a few students, obviously. Every time someone came to his hut, he would hold up his staff and call out his question. And since for 20 years no one could answer him, he would answer for them. "When the ancients got here, why didn't they remain?" "Because it is of no use in everyday life." And again, "What will you do with it?" "Taking no heed of others, I place my staff across my shoulders. I go straight ahead, deep into the recesses of the myriad peaks." The master of Lotus Flower Peak held up a staff. Zen masters are often described as carrying a staff. But what is this staff? Chaucho, that's Joshu in Japanese, said he carried a stick to chase off the dogs. But let's turn to Robert Aitken Roshi's description of this staff. This is from a commentary on case number 44 in the Wumenkan on Pa Chao's staff. He writes, "Every Zen master has a staff that he cuts for himself in the mountains. It is about 7 feet long perhaps with some of its twigs left untrimmed, and is quite ungainly in appearance. This is a staff which Pai Chang used to poke out the dead body of a fox in case number 2. It is a symbol of the master's status as a mountain steward. For every Zen temple is a mountain and has a mountain name, even those located in the heart of busy cities. The master has cut his staff from wild nature in the wild mountains, which is no different from the essential nature set forth by the Buddha Shakyamuni. It has no fancy carving and is really a very ordinary thing. But at the same time, there is no thing more precious. The staff, a wild thing from the wild mountains, Buddha nature. The ancients arrived here. Now, when a teacher speaks of the ancients, he is, of course, referring to the ancestral teachers, all those who preceded him or her, clear back to the Buddha and beyond. So the master holds up his staff, and lo and behold, all the Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, ancestral teachers have arrived. Here they are. The ancient mythic lay disciple of the Buddha, Vimalakirti, was described as a man of enormous wealth, a businessman, householder, the owner of a very large estate, family man, and very involved in public affairs. But he is said to have lived very simply in a 10-foot square hut, which quite easily accommodates thousands upon thousands of bodhisattvas, gods, goddesses, and all kinds of disciples. So it's no surprise, really, that they can also arrive along with a master's staff. How do they do it? And where are they all right now? But why didn't they remain? Why must they not remain? And if they don't remain here, where do they go? And what about Vimalakirti? Does he remain forever in his little hut? Let's all just sit here for a minute and contemplate a question. Why do I practice? Why do I sit in the mornings and the evenings? Why do I come to the temple? Why do I go to Sesshin, put in all those hours on the mat? Why do I bang heads with koan after koan? What's it all for, really? These are important questions, and they come up sometimes even after years of practice. It can be unexpected and even frightening. But it's a question that desperately needs to be resolved, because if it is not, there's a real chance that one may become so discouraged, frustrated, as to abandon practice altogether. That's a terrible tragedy. Nevertheless, there comes a time when one must be totally clear about one's own aspirations. Maybe not at the beginning. In the beginning, it's enough to be faced with just the physical challenges of sitting, the pain, the stiffness, all those early encounters with the chaos of the mind, the great question of mu, standing before one like a tower of adamant. All this one can go through with no clear notion of why one is doing it. It suffices that the imperative is there. The drive is there, and we travel, we know not where, by a road we know not of. But sooner or later, that question of why must be answered clearly and explicitly. I'm not talking about demonstrations in Doksan or anything like that. For oneself. Do we practice in order to arrive here? To experience the dropping away of body and mind? To experience the void we hear so much about? Well, of course we do. That ground of being, the absolute, our Buddha nature, that is vast, unborn, undying, infinite, and eternal. And any other impressive adjectives we can come up with. We pursue it with single-minded intensity, certainly for as long as we're working on an initial koan. Mu, the initial koan, enlightenment practice, becomes the be-all, end-all, the alpha and omega of practice. And it needs to be. At least for many. It certainly was for me. In my early days of practice, I needed that energy, even the desperation. Then one day we get a glimpse, maybe more than a glimpse. And it's wonderful. Suddenly, Mu breaks open. The heavens are astonished. The earth is shaken, writes Wu Min. And then we continue our practice. All the subsequent koans, with its ups and downs, its triumphs and discouragements. And then, perhaps long after the initial kensho, that insidious question begins to creep into one's consciousness. What the hell am I doing? Why am I here? Can be a real crisis of faith. To stop practice at this point, especially after kensho, is the greatest imaginable tragedy. The Buddha said that there are two great mistakes one can make with regard to practice. One is not to begin, and the other is not to continue. In this world, how very few begin and how very, very few continue. And yet somehow, emptiness no longer seems worth it. An experience of emptiness by itself is empty, all right, and not in a good way. When the ancients got here, why didn't they remain? To try to remain in that empty oneness, this here, is a fool's game. It's making your living in a ghost cave. And quite honestly, I think you'll go nuts. I'm going to bend a rule here and read a little bit from a letter that I wrote to Sensei some years ago, because I think it describes the situation pretty well. I wrote, I was finding Zen practice at the Zen Center increasingly difficult. Indeed, my whole relationship to the center and to my practice was becoming sterile, flat, stale, and unprofitable. Koan study was discouraging and seemed less and less relevant to real life. The center was just another place that I had to be at certain times. I thought, what is this? Spiritual practice or just another job? I knew, theoretically at any rate, that practice that happens only on the mat is worse than useless. Yet I didn't know how to extend it into the rest of my life. Perhaps my life had gotten more settled over the years, but there was no obvious connection. That was life, not practice. any benefits were a spillover effect. It just wasn't good enough. No, practice on the mat by itself is not good enough. The absolute by itself is not enough. It will never be enough. Why didn't they remain here? The master asks. Because it is of no use in everyday life. The ancients didn't stay here, and neither can we. We have to move on. Now, it's very easy to say, take your practice off the mat out into the world. Step forward from the top of the 100-foot pole. But how? How do we make that connection? How do we make this of use in everyday life? What is the nuts and bolts method by which we translate our experience on the mat in or out of Sesshin to out there? Well, that's what this Sila Ango is all about. This admittedly somewhat artificial division of our practice year into alternating 3-month angos or training periods. During the Prajna Ango in spring and fall, we work very hard on transcendent wisdom, to enter into silence, to experience that emptiness where there is no eye, nose, tongue, no body, mind. That's the here the master refers to. During the Sila Ango, summer and winter, we move out, engage the world as practice. Prajna and Sila are two sides of the same coin. You cannot have one without the other. To practice only on the mat, to seek only the void, the eternal, the prajna aspect of our nature, is to be only half a person. And it's a formula for insanity. I can't be sure, but I suspect this is what Robert Aitken Roshi means when he says, I have seen strange creatures grow in the Zendo. We need to be whole. We need to be whole and complete, not just here in this shelter that we're so lucky to have, but in our lives. It's the only way we'll truly help others. Those who have been to Sesshin, or perhaps even Zazenkai, may experience this ineffable joy that comes with intense practice and the beginnings of true realization. And there's very often a reluctance to leave the Sesshin. We feel we're leaving behind something precious, something beyond price, when we go back out into the world. Well then, don't leave it behind. Take it with. Wherever you go, take all of you. I'm quoting from my letter again. I wrote, sometime, I don't remember when, I heard you mention daily mindfulness, and it must have rung a bell because I was very intrigued. Not long after that, I asked to take up the daily mindfulness practice. Now, this refers to the practice that we now call Every Minute Zen. And for those who are new or who are visitors, let me say something about this Every Minute Zen practice. And it's going to sound a little bit like a commercial, and it is, because I push this every chance I get. Every Minute Zen practice takes our practice off the mat, out of the Zendo, into the world, into our daily lives in very specific ways. And again, speaking personally, it was the second most important decision I ever made with respect to practice. The most important was naturally to start sitting in the first place. Practically, here's how it works. It's very much like what happens in Samu, work practice at the temple. During the work period here, the densho, the big temple bell, is struck every 15 or 20 minutes to remind us, to bring us out of any trains of thought we might be caught up in, or wool gathering we've been trapped by, bring us back to the here and now. Of course, out in the world, we don't have that bell to remind us. So, periodically, in Doksan or in Daisan, the student is assigned a series of efforts designed to bring one back to the here and the now. Each effort is worked with for a couple of weeks. An example would be every time you walk upstairs or downstairs, you just mentally pause a minute or a moment and recall yourself to yourself. Just settle the mind, just very briefly. After a couple of weeks, the assignment might be changed to, say, opening and closing doors. And so it goes. There's quite a large number of them. And they cover just about all the ordinary things that we do in our daily lives. When Sensei first started teaching this, he would call it Alarm Clock Zen. It's not a bad title. It's not always easy. How many times when I was working on something like recalling myself as I got dressed, would I get halfway to work when I suddenly remembered, oops, I got dressed this morning totally on automatic pilot. Where was I? Another effort is using keys. Every time you lock or unlock a door, again, you stop and recall yourself to yourself. Now, where I work, there are a lot of doors that are kept locked. And I started to really resent all the interruptions. That's how I thought of them. And I started to get furious. I don't want to recall myself. I want to think what I'm thinking. But what was really being interrupted there? The mind road. The constant chatter that goes on in all of us. Well, it showed me my attachments. It was a very good lesson. The important thing here is look at yourself without judgment. If at that moment, when you unlock the door or whatever, if you're ticked off, you're ticked off. If you're happy, you're happy. If you screw up at something, you screw it up. If you're distracted and harried, you're distracted and harried. It's not about trying to be any particular way. It's just about being aware in the moment. It's just a snapshot. After a while, it actually gets to be kind of fun. Every couple of weeks, hey, there's a new challenge, a new aspect of the game. It's fun as long as we don't take ourselves too seriously. As long as we're not demanding some sort of success. You learn to say to yourself, whoops. You say that a lot. And go on. And as we work with each of these efforts, each moment of that awareness becomes a little moment of opening up, of accepting. You find yourself a little less judgmental of people, and maybe of yourself. You find yourself listening a little more carefully, looking a little more carefully. You're a little bit more open to everything. In her talk at the opening of this Ango, Peggy used the analogy of the steel plate that covers the heart. Yeah, every time we stop and recall ourselves, that plate slides a little bit more open. And gradually these mindfulness exercises start to merge into more and more of a continuing awareness of what is. Again, quoting from that letter. Somehow connections were made. Life and practice began to merge. In the last year and a half, I've been much more able to drop the nonsense and see my own reactions to things. At times, when I've been sitting regularly and working hard with the mindfulness practice, life begins to feel like day six of Sesshin. No barriers. I just fly through the day. Other times, I bog down. That's okay, too. Just as long as I can see it. So we have to be careful. This practice is not about getting good at something. It is true that at Samu, or when any time one really works at being present in the moment, things often do go better. When we're washing dishes, using an electric drill, running a vacuum cleaner. But if you drop a dish on the floor, that's not a failure. On or off the mat, do not be concerned with results. That's like looking for enlightenment. How many times does Sensei admonish us to focus clearly and accurately on the practice? Whether it is Mu, or the breath on the mat, mindfulness off the mat, focus on the practice, not on some expected result. Trust Mu. Trust the practice. The importance that Zen masters and teachers place on every minute Zen is illustrated in a story from, once again, one of my favorite scriptures, the little book Zen Flesh, Zen Bones by Nyogen Senzaki and Paul Reps. And the story goes like this. Zen students are with their masters at least 10 years before they presume to teach others. Nan-in was visited by Tenno, who, having passed his apprenticeship, had become a teacher. The day happened to be rainy, so Tenno wore wooden clogs and carried an umbrella. After greeting him, Nan-in remarked, "I suppose you left your wooden clogs in the vestibule. I want to know if your umbrella is on the right or the left side of the clogs." Tenno, confused, had no instant answer. He realized that he was unable to carry his Zen every minute. He became Nan-in's pupil, and he studied 6 more years to accomplish his every minute Zen. Now that's a person of integrity. Here we have a sanctioned teacher who has truly encountered the absolute, but he discovered he could not use it in everyday life. So he gave up teaching and stayed with Nan-in for 6 more years before going back to teaching. But again, be careful here. Tenno's failure, if you want to call it that, was not that he didn't remember where he put his clogs and his umbrella. Mindfulness is not about cultivating some kind of eidetic memory. It's not about right and wrong. It's about awareness in this moment and about coming forth instantly and spontaneously out of that awareness. So the master asks us now, what will you do with it? What will we do with it? Do we have a plan? Do we have some fixed idea of what to do with our lives, with our practice? What will you do? What will you do when you get off the mat and leave the center and go out into the street? Are you making plans? When the last bell sounds, do we suddenly start scheming and dreaming about what we're going to do? That's something of a loaded question. There's a story of a prince of ancient China who was a very serious practitioner. He was asked by his teacher, "How will you rule the people?" The prince replied, "With wisdom and compassion." The teacher said, "Then every one of them will suffer." Bodhin Kolhed, who is the current abbot of the Rochester Zen Center and Dharma successor of Kapla Roshi, was asked during the ceremony of his installation, "What will you do as a sanctioned teacher?" Bodhin replied, "Looking. Just looking." Once when Mother Teresa was in the United States to dedicate a new center for the care of the poor and the sick, a young man came up to her and expressed a desire to do volunteer work, but he was unsure of what he would do as a volunteer, and he asked her for some guidance. Mother Teresa said, come and see. Come to the center and you will see what you will do. Do we get the point here? We don't know what we're going to do. We can never know. We have no clue what will happen 5 seconds from now, let alone 5 minutes, 5 hours, or 5 years. So we better pay attention to this moment. It's all we have. Yes, we sometimes make plans. Plans for our kids, plans for our own future, plans for retirement. That's okay, that's being responsible. But we can't be attached to them. Circumstances change, the universe has changed. It's totally unpredictable. In the end, it's the practice, the looking, the seeing, the listening. Everything else will take care of itself. We will see what we will do. Just look. Just listen. Taking no heed of others, I place my staff across my shoulders. I go straight ahead, deep into the myriad peaks. Taking no heed of others. Who are these others? It's our separated selves, our own separateness. The expectations and requirements we place on ourselves, either explicitly or those we buy into as coming from what in our delusion we call others. I place my staff across my shoulders. There's that staff. Buddha nature takes the staff with him. Of course he does. It's as much a part of him as his own head. Each of us carries that staff. Each of us is that staff. My staff across my shoulders. He's perfectly comfortable with it. We use a staff in the temple during the opening ceremony of Shosan, Dharma exchange. The tanto, as part of the ceremony, carries it in a very formal way in both hands, circumambulating the zendo. But the master just throws it across his shoulders and off he goes, straight ahead, deep into the recesses of the myriad peaks. I place my staff across my shoulders, I go straight ahead, into the 5 o'clock rush hour in the T-Rex construction zone, straight ahead into the political squabbles at my job, straight ahead into my family, kids, mortgages. Do not shrink from life. Do not fear to enter fully into the circumstances of life, but at the same time, to be no more disturbed by them than a great mountain is by a passing thunder squall. Well, we do the best we can. And as we do this practice, we eventually make an amazing discovery. That life is discovery. Practice is discovery on and off the mat. Every moment, every step, every move, every breath, we discover and rediscover who and what we are. Each moment is discovery. Each moment is a wonder. Each moment is brand new, never seen before, never to be seen again. Staff across our shoulders, off we go on our journey of moment-to-moment discovery. When a bird sings outside the window, we discover ourselves. When the horns honk in the street, we discover ourselves. When we wash dishes, type on the computer, take the cat to the vet, the universe discovers itself. Let's go back to Vimalakirti for a little more instruction. Shariputra was one of the most senior disciples of the Buddha, and he's doing serious zazen under a tree. Along comes Vimalakirti, who says, "Reverend Shariputra, this is not the way to absorb yourself in contemplation. You should absorb yourself in contemplation in such a way that you can manifest all ordinary behavior without forsaking cessation." Cessation means nirvana. "You should absorb yourself in contemplation in such a way that you can manifest the nature of an ordinary person without abandoning your cultivated spiritual nature. You should absorb yourself in contemplation in such a way that you are released in liberation without abandoning the passions that are the province of the world." Absorb yourself in contemplation in such a way that you are released in liberation without abandoning the passions that are the province of the world. Now there's an assignment. We remain in the world, and at the same time we are in nirvana. The two arrows meeting in midair, form and emptiness. Meeting in midair is not an event. It is the continuing eternal reality. This earth where we stand is the pure lotus land. Shwedo's verse. Dust and sand in his eyes, dirt in his ears. He doesn't consent to stay in the myriad peaks. Falling flowers, flowing streams, very vast. Suddenly raising my eyebrows to look, where has he gone? Where has he gone? When one speaks of someone who is deeply realized, we raise our eyebrows to look and we see nothing special. There is no one there who is enlightened, no one who desires to be enlightened or to be anything in particular. A rare person indeed, who passes unnoticed in the world. Dust and sand in his eyes, he's blind, for there is no one to see and nothing to be seen. Dirt in his ears, deaf, because there is no one to hear and nothing to be heard. The person who advances in the way is an ordinary person. We work so hard, so very hard, spend so much energy to maintain that tottering facade of the separate self. And we don't have to. We really don't have to. What a relief. Robert Aitken Roshi refers to Doksan as joyful exploration in the room together. The master of Lotus Flower Peak shows us another side. Joyful exploration in the world, together with all beings. And together with all beings, we attain Buddhahood.